What's up, guys? As you all know, I am a huge bass kayak fishing fan. I love to bass fish from my kayak. And so if you're like me, when you first got into fishing, you started looking online for some bait casters, perhaps some spinning rods, spinning reels, and you got sticker shock. You could not believe how expensive this quality stuff is. And that's how I got turned on to Cast King. I started looking for high-end quality fishing equipment that people could afford. And that is Cast King's, that's their slug line, affordable fishing innovation. And they tell the truth. I enjoyed their fishing equipment so much that I went out and initiated contact with Cast King to become an ambassador. I have been an ambassador now for 2.5 years. I don't bring it up a lot. But hey, I just want to say to y'all, if you want to help support the show, you're looking for some quality fishing equipment, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com/fish, click on the link, check out the Cast King gear. You'll be happy you did. I'll get a little bit of thank you from Cast King. You're supporting the show. We're all happy. Thank you so much. Now on to the show.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And the trio is back together. We ride again. What's going on, Jeff? How you been, fella? It's been a while.
It's been way too long, but yeah, we ride again, and I'm pumped about it, man. It's been a long time coming, and I'm really excited about this show.
And in the center square tonight, joining us as always, Mr. Dennis Blocker. Dennis, how you doing down there, fella?
All right. Doing all right.
It's like the World War II Hollywood Squares. Everything good down there? Down on the lonely bottom row?
Yeah. Doing all right.
What's going on, Jeff? So how you been?
Man, well, yeah, we've got lots of updates for our listeners, and man, feels like I've been around the world, and I think I'm about 5 years smarter than I was a month ago. Was really fortunate to be a part of the Sky Fiesta Las Cruces, which is an air fest, air show / air races in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Did that back in October. So it was a different event for me. I see you're like air races. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say for our audience, are we talking like the Red Bull style with the inflatable pylons that they fly around?
Pretty similar to
the Red Bull logo.
Yeah, very, very similar. They didn't have inflatable pylons. They actually drilled them into the ground. But they were, you know, the composite RV-type aircraft, very lightweight. And that was, like, kind of mixed in within some of the other air acts. So it wasn't just, wow, look at those airplanes flying in a circle. you know, there was some vintage aircraft there. Tab was there. That's all brother, our local C-47 D-Day veteran. Tab showed up, Yellow Rose, our B-25, showed up. And so I mean, it was just a little bit of everything, and I didn't know what to expect. I've never been to an air race, Sky Fiesta, before. So it was great because you had World War II aircraft, you had Korean War era. They actually had a flight of 3 MiG-17s doing some amazing, they were really showing off at the end, lighting up afterburners. Did a 1,000-foot firewall, just, you know, strafing runs and everything, bomb runs. Then there was, you know, myself with my war wagon, some guys from Liberty Jump Team that were there. All Airborne Battalion parachute team that was there. You know, vintage cars and some other things. So it was like, it was incredible. And it really took, honestly, it took the entire state of New Mexico to fund it, to get it going. So
now, like, Las Cruces, you say the entire state, not to cut you off, you literally mean it was state funded through?
Yeah. The state of New Mexico, I think there was a representative there that the night before, talking about, and I want to say, and I hope I'm not misquoted here, but I think the state of New Mexico alone donated like $1 million towards getting the event done. Yeah, so they had a really big budget. You know, it was all volunteer run. So it was really cool to see it come together and to see that.
For that event? Is this the first
Well,
year?
No, and there were some complications. You know, last year there was a fatal, and the way I understand it, it wasn't during the air show. I think it was prior to. So that kind of really, I mean, we know what that's like in the air show world, right? You have something like that, a very unfortunate accident, and it really shuts a lot of things down. It makes a lot of, you know, people go, ooh, So I think that's what happened to Las Cruces, and so I think the city kind of pulled out, but a lot of folks there, they still wanted to do it. They just had to find funding and volunteers from other sources, and they absolutely rocked it. So it was really, really cool. So did a ground demo there. I think they reached over 10,000 people. I've heard as high as 12,000. I'm not sure. So attendance was big for a one day event. So really cool to get to talk to that many people, about, you know, what's the scuttlebutt and some of the other things that we do in living history. So, really cool opportunity. Turned around, went to the Dallas Aviation Discovery Fest in Dallas. Same thing, got to pull out the display. Lots of living history guys there. Of course, as the world knows, unfortunately, you know, back in September, we lost John Luckadoo from the 100th Bomb Group, and he was kind of a regular at that event. So, you know, had to flex and do some other things without a World War II veteran there, you know, as seems to be the case lately. So yeah, and then some exciting other updates that I think Dennis probably has told you about, but I don't think we've mentioned the listeners. And Don, we're gonna rope you into this, you know, at some
Real quick,
point.
before you get into that, before you get into
Yeah.
that, because you kind of sped through it, but I wanted to ask you about the wagon. The roots of this podcast, for those of you guys who are new, yes, we do. We talk a lot of actors and authors and all that, but the basic root of this podcast is, living history and the hobby and all that. And one of the tediums of being a living historian is packing up your crap, shipping it out, setting it up, which isn't bad. But then after a day or two, it's the tearing it down, packing it back up, putting it in your vehicle, driving it all the way home, unpacking it, putting it back in its permanent place that it sits until the next event, where you have done what a lot of people have done, but most people do it for storage, meaning I'm going to put my stuff in this trailer, put the trailer in my garage, pull it out. Where you have kind of turned yours into a portable, quick setup kind of mobile museum and display. I'm sure you put some of it out in front of the trailer too, but you use the interior space as kind of a walk-in closet style museum, if you will. How has that transition gone for you? Have you found little things you want to fix? What's the size of your trailer, et cetera?
Yeah. So honestly, I bought an enclosed trailer just to travel with the Jeep, right? You know, borrowing a flatbed from a buddy or whatever. It's just, you know, you can only do that for so long. And yeah, when you put a 42 GPW on a flatbed, you're going to get a lot of looks, questions. You stop at gas and it's a conversation, right? But it's, you know, exposed to elements. You're doing 70 miles an hour, rocks are flying.
Yeah, it reminds me of the meme you see where you get a classic car, you think you're going to pick up chicks, but it mainly just brings out old men at the gas station.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, you're talking about debris, rocks, potential cracking in the windshield, things of that nature.
Yeah, you know, I noticed you definitely can't travel with the canvas top up, so then you're folding that down, you're folding the windshield down, anything that could blow away, so you can't really store anything in it. So it worked for you know, temporarily, but so I knew taking that trailer to Dallas, or taking the Jeep on a flatbed trailer to Dallas. I think I did that twice, and I took it to one or two other events. I knew that time was limited if I was going to really preserve this vehicle. So I, you know, found a really nice used, very gently used, enclosed trailer. It's 7 feet wide, 16 feet long. So it's got a drop-down ramp. A guy actually just stored his riding mower in it. You know, wasn't really wasn't heavily used. So got a great deal on it, and just used it to put the Jeep in. And then one day I was in there, and I just kind of had a vision, and that turned into, you know, painting the walls a close match to the green zinc chromate inside of a B-17. refurbished the plywood floors, and then went through. So when you walk in, you get there. It fits 2 12-foot tables down the long wall, and you get the impression of a navigator's compartment in a B-17 up in the nose. Then you kind of transition around to some of the combat gear that they would wear. So this is, the tools of the trade for a navigator, bombardier. There's some gauges there, and then it transitions to the flight gear. The gloves, the throat mic, the oxygen mask, the goggles, and then it kind of comes around as you go to the front of the trailer, and where that kind of tapers into a point. I recreated basically the personal space, the barracks in England, the footlockers, the pinups, the pocket trash, the coins, the letters from home, the shoe polish, the hair tonic, personal books and things like that, socks, whatever, just to kind of show what life was like not on a mission. And then down the short wall is Pacific themed. So it's, a Japanese flag or a Navy signal flag, ration tokens, photographs from Pacific battles, and everything that's on the walls is laminated and attached in a way, or if it's in a wood frame, it's bratted to the wall. So like everything on the wall stays. Even I've got stuff all over the ceiling. So every time I take it somewhere, people always marvel. They have to like watch, like, I actually want to see you fit this Jeep into this trailer because I
Not
want to see how
knocking
you do
stuff
this.
off the wall. So, somebody who's been carrying a firearm for over 13 years daily, one of the biggest inconveniences is when you come home, you need to take your firearm off of yourself and put it somewhere safe, somewhere secure, especially if you have kids. Now, I know most of us are responsible. We have a gun safe somewhere, but let's be honest. Usually these gun safes are big, they're bulky, they're kind of out of the way because they're a bit of an eyesore. Your wife doesn't want them where everybody can see them. So sometimes they're in your closet behind some clothes, sometimes they're in the garage, sometimes they're in the mudroom. And let's be honest, taking your firearm out and walking to those locations to secure it is a pain in the butt, but you have to be a responsible firearm owner, especially if you have kids in the house. That's why you need to get yourself a Stop Box Pro portable gun safe. You can make it non-portable. You can drill some holes in it, mount it to a place of convenience in your house, but it requires no batteries and no electricity. You simply come in your house, walk up to your safe, choose your finger button combinations, open a safe, remove your firearm from your person, put it in the safe. If you close your safe, just that easy, it's secure. So do yourself a favor, head over to stopboxusa.com/D410 and get all the information today on your Stop Box Pro. When seconds count, trust the only non-fail firearm storage box, Stop Box Pro, at stopboxusa.com/D410.
Yeah.
Question. You said the long wall and the short wall. Dennis and I were talking about this off air when we were trying to do a previously scheduled show that fell through. Your long wall, is it 16 feet long?
Yes.
So 12 feet safe.
Essentially, yeah. And then it to the taper. Yeah,
Do
it's
you
16.
hypothetically have a space about 12 feet long by maybe a foot and a half tall along the top of that wall of clear space right now? Or could you
I
make
don't have
clear
any
space?
clear space in it. Do I need to make space?
Well, the reason I asked, I sent Dennis a picture of a banner. We were talking about that banner last week. It's a 12-foot long banner that says United We Stand. It's an original banner that was flown at USO shows, military, whatever. And it just says United We Stand. And then it has the red squares with the Army Eagle badge that you'd wear on your lapel on each end. It's original. I bought it on eBay, but I don't have a 12-foot long span in any of my rooms. So I would happily send it to you. And I thought it'd be great if you put it like in a frame, you could just put it at the top of that wall because it's 12 feet, or you can put it wherever you want. But I'm just saying it's 12 feet long is kind of a stretch for someone to frame something and have it in their house. But if you have a 12
Right.
foot wall and it's only about a foot and a half tall, so you just have to clear off a strip at the top and it would go up there perfectly. So it's just an option. If you want
Honestly.
it, I'll send it out to you and you can look at it and either keep it or just keep it in the tube. I have it in a post or two, but it's been sitting in my office at work for like a year and a half because I have no place for it.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that on the outside of the trailer, even, not permanently mounted, but just
Yeah.
to hang on the outside to kind of get some attention. And I know
Yeah, put it in
Dennis
UV protective
probably.
glass so it keeps, because it's a bright, beautiful red. It's not faded at
Yeah,
all. This
yeah.
thing was like taken down, put in a tube. It's been sitting in a tube for 75 years. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll find a home for it for sure.
Just I just texted you the images there, Jeff.
And so
okay.
And so you're able to pull your Jeep into this without knocking the things off the wall. And obviously you have things stacked and then you bring them down
right.
and set up your display and then put the Jeep out front.
Yeah, it's essentially like five foot lockers that all stack up at the front, and then my field table and the folding tables, they just fold up, and the Jeep straddles those. They just stay on the ground. So everything just goes up at the front, and then it's got tie down, so I drive the Jeep up and strap it down and go on my way.
I have a very, very...
It's about a 30 to 40 minute setup. That's all it takes.
That's not bad at all.
No.
And it's all protected. Most of it's protected from the sun. Because here in Florida, I mean, that's the big thing is you get to see guys' stuff that gets bleached out, especially haversacks, musette bags, uniforms. Uniforms, we don't care, right? Because it looks salty. But when you have original gear, you kind of hope that, you know, you don't care if the reproduction stuff fades. But how tall are you?
5'11".
Did you relocate your driver's seat in any way, shape, or form on that Jeep?
Negative.
How do you fit? Here's why I bring it up. The weekend of Halloween, we had VKE this year, and one of the German's wife does Army impression, and she recently acquired a Marine Corps Jeep. And it was having some problems. We got it up and running, but she had a trailer much like yours. Her husband has hip problems. He was in the airborne, so his back and his lower back is just completely destroyed from all the years of jumping and all that. And they asked if anybody could pull this thing in their trailer. I have been in Jeeps. I've been most of my time in the back. Occasionally I'll sit in a passenger with my long legs sticking out the passenger side, but I've never driven one in all my years. Now, the first four cars I ever had were standard, so I wasn't worried about that. Anyhow, long story short, I sat in this thing. And now, for those of you at home, reverse is where modern-day first gear is. First gear is where modern-day second gear is, so you got to go down. I literally had to open my legs and shift down. And my right leg was on the opposite side. I could not fit in this damn thing. I'm like full spread eagle, just like to get my foot on the clutch and the gas. I'm like doing like some weird yoga pose. First time driving a Jeep. I haven't driven a standard in probably 5 years. Never pulled a vehicle into a utility trailer. I pulled that son of a bitch in, didn't stall, didn't spit, didn't sputter, didn't hit a single wire, didn't hit the guidelines. Went right in like I've been driving. I was like, I climbed out of this thing because now you know, the walls are 4 inches from the edge. I climb out of this thing and I was like, what, not even a good job. But I was proud of myself that I didn't stall this thing out, didn't even snag the line. But more importantly, I was just like, if I ever, you know, a lot of reenactors, we all have a dream of possibly owning a Jeep. I'm like, I would have to like dismount the seat, move it back 4 inches, drill new. There's no way I could drive one of those comfortably at all. I'm just way too ridiculously tall. And so I was like, well, Jeff's not that much shorter than me. How the hell does he drive one of these things? I guess you just cram yourself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think back to, and I use this quite often because I get that a lot. Like, oh man, I could never fit in that thing. Like, if you watch Charlton Heston hop in and out of that very easily in the Midway film.
Yeah, but they could have very well he's moved his back 5 inches. I mean, they do that a lot of stuff.
It doesn't look like it. Okay. I mean, because it's not flat right behind the seat. It steps up, so it would be a complete remod because it fits over. That's where the gas tank is on the World War II.
Oh, no, you're right. It is on the driver's side.
Yeah. So there's no moving the seat back.
Yeah, that's true.
That's So it can be done. I do it all the time, and I'm. But of course, you know, I'm not 6'4" either. But you know, Jimmy Stewart probably drove Jeeps as well, and he's a pretty tall, lanky guy too. So it, I don't know, they just did it, and you know, it's funny because when I do parades, I may have four or five kiddos in the back seat, and they feel like they're crammed, and then I'll show them a picture of 11 crew members from a B-17 that are all crammed on a 1/4 ton with their flight bags. And it's like, you know, you can fit one more.
We like to be macho and brave and all that, but I'll tell you what, at the VKE, we've explained it, acknowledged him on the show, but when we lead the museum, the Allies, we got to drive down to the other end of the track. So we're driving 5 or 6 miles on a modern 3-lane thoroughfare. And so I'm running in the back of Joseph's Jeep, and I'm kind of sitting on top of the seat, but kind of using the spare tire like a sissy bar on a motorcycle. And I'm kind of holding on to it because he has a Ma Deuce mounted on it. But we're, you know, he's got this thing pegged. We're cruising at a brisk, what, 48.5 miles an hour? Yeah. The three of us. We got to go through a traffic circle. I'm like, lean. Cause it's, you know, you got leaf springs. This thing's like going through a traffic circle. But more importantly, it's like, fellas, we're talking drum brakes here. We're cruising a good 46 and a half, which in a Jeep, 1943 Jeep in uniform, it feels like you're doing 85. Of course, you got the annoyed people behind you, like riding your ass. And Joseph, he kind of almost missed that hard right-hand turn. And of course, someone's sitting at that light and, you know, no turn signal. So we're all doing this. Just kind of, I'm like, oh, drum brakes, please, buy supply tires. Oh, please make this turn. And I'm like, the older I get, the more scary that drum brakes, bias ply tire, 45 mile an hour trip around that right hand turn gets scarier every year. And it's just like, granted at the time it's high end newest technology, but just hauling ass to a muddy field, trying to outrun an artillery strike, and you're on drum brakes, bias ply tires, no power steering, and you're getting shot at, and you got, you know, as many guys as you can crammed on that, or some poor son of a bitch on a stretcher across the hood with the windshield down. It's like, oh, no wonder Patton got killed by one of these damn things, because, you know, the brakes, it's a sketchy ride. And one year we were making that same ride with the Bouvet brothers, and they had their weapons carrier, and that big open son of a bitch, you know, what is it? Four wheels in the back, two up front, same thing, hauling ass. Oh, here comes a turn. Break. Nope. We just kind of slid right into the field. It's like, oh crap. Every time, like, no, this is how it ends. I just have vision. There's no seatbelts on the damn thing, and you're on concrete. So here we go. But yeah, it's definitely an adventure. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, but that's what made the Jeep so valuable, right? I mean, I was talking about this with somebody not that long ago. I was at the motorcycle museum. We've got one here in town. And reading the story of the original Indian and the WLA Harleys, you know, used by the Army. And I didn't realize the correlation that the Jeeps had to the motorcycles, to the horse, you know, the original horse-drawn cavalry, you know, essentially my heritage in the Army. You know, I knew about the motorcycles, right? And they were trying to replace the horse, and that worked out okay. But then once the Jeep came along, they were like, well, the Jeep can do everything that this motorcycle can do, and then some. We don't need a two-wheel, you know, vehicle anymore. We'll just take the Jeep. So when you think about that, like, yeah, the Jeep can do everything that – anywhere that you can put a motorcycle, a two-wheel vehicle, the Jeep's going to go there too. And it may not be pretty, but it's going to get you there, and it's going to bring you back.
I think the Germans, because they didn't have a Jeep, obviously they had the Volkswagen thing, but – I think they had a sidecar on their BMWs, but it had a axle drive, almost making it three-wheel drive. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them actually had an axle drive so that the tire on the sidecar dug and got a little extra traction too.
That sounds like German engineering. It would probably take a team of 20 guys to fix it if it ever broke.
Yep. More to detach that sidecar.
Yeah.
And so the event all in all went pretty well?
Yeah. Several events here lately. I've done three air shows, I think, in about the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, I think I cut you off. I was interested about the trail. You said you were going to go to Dallas next, correct?
No, did Dallas. So did Las Cruces, and then just a few weeks later did Dallas. Gotcha. Turned around 2 weeks after that, did an air show about 25, 30 miles from here, which was – that was great. I was the only World War II representative. But it was really cool. It was the first time, and this was new for me, it was the first time to put together an act for Vietnam. And if there's any guys that love Vietnam that are listening, and guys and gals, so 5 days before this air show, I get a call from the air boss. Hey, Jeff, there's going to be a Huey there. Mm-hmm. Do you think you can put together a script and we can recreate what it was like to rescue a downed pilot behind enemy lines in Vietnam? Okay. And he says, all right, well, I'm gonna call you on Wednesday and we'll hash everything out, see if you can get your script done before then. So in 48 hours, I became an expert on the air rescue service in Vietnam, started reading all kinds of books, all kinds of articles, journals and things, everything that I could get my hands on, to figure out how it was done. There is no how it was done, just by the way. There's no standard that I could find. There were several different variants of helicopters that were used. Of course, you had all the other complements with the Sky Raiders or the O2 Bird Dogs and all the other aircraft that kind of made it possible. But one interesting thing I learned was the very first helicopter rescue was in Burma in 1944.
Now, I knew we had
This I did not know.
Korean, but I didn't know we had them out earlier than that.
I mean, I've seen a few pictures of the choppers on Iwo Jima, and I've, they were used for downed airman rescue. But yeah, it was a let me see if I can pull up the it was a YR4, and we only had about 30 at the time, and it was actually a British well, it was British that were wounded, I think. It was an American pilot and an L1, but I think he had a couple British wounded soldiers, and they had to put it down. They had to put the aircraft down, and they couldn't get to him except for with this YR4. So they picked him up in the chopper, and the YR4 brought him somewhere else where another aircraft could get in and evacuate the wounded. So it was essentially the first helicopter rescue was in World War II. That blew my mind. So we put the script together, and I called in some reenactors from Louisiana and all over the place, and we all came together to so I would narrate what was going on as this Huey was flying around making gun run passes with the pyrotechnics. Our guys are out there with a couple M16s and an M14 and a Prick 77. Like, they've got comms with the Huey pilot. They pop smoke, and after a few gun run passes, the chopper lands, and they enter on either side of the chopper, and they had a harness that the pilot had put in them, prior to put under their uniform. So he clips them in, so they take off with their feet dangling off the sides, and they do some photo passes in front of the crowd. Of course, Fortunate Son's playing in the background, and Vietnam vets are crying. Oh my God, that was amazing! Oh, the Huey, So
That
I had
sound is
never
unmistakable.
absolutely just two rotor or two blades slap in the air,
When I moved to Cape Coral, we have the Lee County, we call it the Lee County Air Force, but they do mosquito control because it's all swampland out here. And for the first 10 years, it was in a Huey. And you always heard it coming in, boom, 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 boom. It's like, here comes the mosquito. Here comes the Lee County Air Force. But yeah, for years, they were up in there, Huey. We have some of my members of my 2nd Ranger Battalion, they and the Florida Regimental Combat Team, they do Vietnam. And one of our reenactors flies. He's a certified pilot, but he also flies for the Military Vehicle Preservation Society. And so whenever they do their Vietnam shows, at some of the places, airspace, obviously granted, they have a fire base set up and they'll have the Huey come in and our guys will do the same thing. They go in there and clip in and fly in and out. And it's so cool to see. They've been trying to get me to join. It's like, I can't put together another impression. I can't even begin to, start trying to get a, an AR, make it look like an M16 and like, well, the boots and all stuff. It's like, I just don't, I don't, don't, I just can't. Not that I just can't. I won't allow myself to.
Have the energy for another war.
Yeah. I don't have the space for another war. It's all
But
going out.
it was cool. It was a lot of fun. It was new for me, and of course the only problem is we totally rocked it, so we're gonna have to do it again and
That's
again
the
and
only
again.
thing.
But yeah, and then I think the biggest update that I can't wait to tell everybody about, and I think, like I said, I think Dennis kind of lets you in on this, and we're gonna be roping you in some capacity once this thing gets rolling. So I hope you don't mind me talking about it
Oh,
on
please.
WTSB.
Go ahead.
But we've got a team of five. Well, I shouldn't say team. It's our board. Dennis and I finally kind of got the nudge. All of the stars and planets finally aligned, and what we've been talking about for years now has finally come to fruition. We have started a World War II based nonprofit. Now, of course, the nonprofit status is pending. It takes a little while. But just, the conversations that Dennis and I have had over the years, and all of the experiences that we've had, It's just, honestly, it's about time. And, you know, this thing is born out of necessity, honestly, as we are losing, you know, our World War II veterans just due to the nature of you can't live forever. And we want to make sure that all of these stories are preserved in some capacity. Because Dennis, I think, you know, he found an unbelievable statistic that, you know, it could be as many as 90% of Americans have a direct lineage to a World War II veteran based off of, you know, the birth rates through the generations.
You
So
want me to
that's not an
tell them the
exact.
math?
Yeah, please.
Do you
Yeah,
mind if
go
I
ahead.
do that?
No, yeah.
It's pretty it's pretty cool.
Speak up a little bit since you don't have your mic close by.
So here's the math on that. 16.4 million men and women served during World War II. World War II veterans overwhelmingly became parents, and the majority returned home and started families. The estimated average number of children per World War II veteran family was 2.8 per veteran, based on U.S. fertility rates in the late 1940s and the 50s. So 16.4 million veterans times 2.8 children comes out to 46 million children of World War II veterans. Those children had children. The baby boomers had Generation X. Average children per baby boomer was two. So 46 million times two is 92 million grandchildren of World War II veterans. And then Generation X had kids, and theirs was 1.8. So 92 million times 1.8 is 165 million great grandchildren of World War II veterans. Combining all the generations still alive today, to include the baby boomers, Generation X, and the millennials, you get 303 million people alive today in the U.S. with a direct family link to a World War II veteran.
And those are
And
kind
that
of
comes out to
conservative
roughly
numbers.
90%.
Yeah, those are kind of conservative numbers because as you're going through, I'm like, well, my grandfather had four kids, and then my mom alone had three kids.
My grandpa had
Sister,
six.
yeah.
Yeah.
My sister had a kid, I had two, and then, you know, each one of them, you know, my aunt had three sons, and my other aunt had three daughters, and my uncle had two, you know, son and daughter. So yeah, I mean, those are conservative numbers. And yeah, it's and you know, we're all guilty of it, depending on where we live. Here in America, we only think about Americans who have ancestors, but no, everybody around the planet was involved in this thing. And regardless of what military they served for or what civilian population was affected by this, I mean, we think oftentimes when we think World War II, we think of the direct impact of vets, which here in the United States and Canada makes sense, right? Because the war wasn't brought to us. But you know, you're on these islands in the Pacific or you're in one of these countries over in Europe. Where, you know, yeah, none of your direct family members served in the military, but your grandfather's house was bombed, or your, you know, your great aunt was killed in a bomb strike. Yeah, it would make perfect sense that so many, such a large populace of the earth has some sort of relative connection to anything based around World War II. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so, you know, with that kind of reach, it really it puts the significance of this nonprofit in real time, in real numbers, how big this really could get. So essentially, we're calling it the Conservators of the Greatest Generation, or COG, the acronym COGG. So it's, to me, it's perfectly fitting for what we want to do in preserving, protecting, and honoring the legacy of our World War II veterans through numerous avenues of protection and preserving them through documents, letters, journals, photographs, artifacts. That's the tangible things. But then also the fundraising for authors, historians, potentially other nonprofits, other museums that may not have the budget. You know, so it's just it goes on and on. With what we're it's ambitious. I think it's the best. It's ambitious, it's huge, and it's a little scary because there's five of us right now that are been working very hard to kind of nurture this thing and kind of, you know, mold it into what we want it to be. But then once we release this thing, the potential impact is going to be enormous. And Don, of course, Now more than ever, we wish geographically you were a little closer to us because the event that we're planning for February is really going to knock your socks off.
February of this coming year and 26.
February of 26. We've got an event that we are really wanting to plug. And Dennis, do you want to go ahead and talk some of the details? You want us to hold
Sure.
back a little bit?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So, this is Dennis's baby, and I want everybody to be aware of that, because without Dennis really finding some of this out, and making these contacts, it wouldn't be possible. I'm just happy to be a part of this thing. But from a previous guest here on What's the Scuttlebutt, and you remember Andrew Boer and the story of the Weslaco 8, which among those was Harlan Block, who's now made infamous as one of the Iwo Jima flag raisers. Harlan was from a small town here, South Texas, Weslaco. He enlists on the roof of a building. The building was the Marine Corps induction building at the time in San Antonio. But for whatever reason, these boys wanted to enlist on the roof, which is cool, right? Why not, right? Yeah, the beautiful skyline of San Antonio in the 1940s. What a cool thing to do. It was a flagpole. And lo and behold, after seeing this photo, Dennis finds the building and links up with the owner, and then shows the owner, "Hey, this is what happened on the roof of your building. This guy right here did this." And of course shows the famous flag raising photo on Suribachi. So now there was a buy-in from the building owner, and the drive and the initiative to preserve this, and to honestly, to expose the history here, to educate people that this is what happened here. So Dennis created this program to designing several plaques that will be revealed in February, close to the anniversary of not only Harlan Block enlisting in the Marine Corps, but of course the anniversary to the famous photo of the flag raising. And we've now since partnered with the Marine Corps, who's actually going to swear in several boots that night at the event. And just to kind of honor the history of the building, the history of the Marine Corps and the legacy there. And then, of course, specifically Harlan Block and those other boys from Weslaco that, answered the call for their country. And especially for Harlan, didn't get to come home. And enjoy it today. So again, when you think about the reach of an event like that, the potential that it's going to have, and like Dennis uses the word perfectly, the pilgrimage that Marines are going to make to this rooftop. How many Marines are now going to re-enlist right here at this new plaque dedicated spot at this flagpole? People choose the Alamo, people choose all things that are dear to them. But any of those Marines who love history, to be able to stand exactly where Harlan Block stood, once word gets out, they're going to be busy.
Two questions. One, obviously, it's going to take longer than 4 months to get this done, but has there been any talks by the building owner to try to get this registered as a historical landmark so that the building in and of itself can be protected in the future?
That's
Yeah,
Dennis's lane.
so I contact I worked with the city of San Antonio, seventh largest city in the United States, and I put together a dossier of the documents, Harlan Block's actual induction document from his paper, which shows the heading United States Marine Corps, Southern Recruiting District Headquarters, San Antonio, Texas, 118 Broadway. This very same building, the very same address, the very same rooftop. I then in court also included the picture of course, denoting Harlan Block in the photograph, and then Harlan Block in the famous flag raising photograph, and put together, pictures, documentation, this and that, historical significance, and submitted the documents to the city's historical preservation branch. And I heard back. I had didn't hear back for a couple weeks, and I kind of reached out and was like, "Hey, I'm just wondering what the progress is. I'm hoping that what I provided was adequate." And she chuckled on the phone and she says, actually, I was showing some of my coworkers the documentation you provided this morning. We've never had better documentation for a history plaque. She says, this could serve as the hallmark for how this sort of documentation should be provided, because it, the way it's done, Mr. Blocker, it's like you can't even deny that she's like it's important and it needs to happen.
No follow-up.
So the city of San Antonio,
no follow-up request for information on our behalf. You've already given
right. Yeah, and so she's like, yes, it's definitely going to happen. And so we did get the proof of the plaque. The city, it's called it's There a History Here program. Comes with a QR code. The picture of the guys wearing in will be on the cover of the plaque, the front of the plaque, and then a little information about, you know, the fact that the building was used as an induction center for the Marine Corps during World War II, that Harlan Block was involved and that he would raise the flag at Iwo Jima, and that thousands of young men from across South Texas were inducted there. And what's great is that there's a QR code that they have on the plaque that folks and visitors and tourists can, and Marine Corps pilgrims can scan, and it takes them to further information, videos that we'll make and documentation, extra photographs, stuff like that.
Now, is the building already kind of set up where it's easy access to this location, or is the building manager going to have to, owner going to have to kind of do a little finagling and reconstruction on the inside to accommodate people's requests?
So I think that the location of the plaques is almost, I don't think it could have been better, because it's almost a Goonies sort of a thing where you have to go through a hatch and you have to emerge onto it. It's going to become its own lore, I think, because of the way you have to get, what do you think, Jeff? It's like, it's not convenient. And I think it adds to it because it's not.
At some point, if this thing kind of becomes the pilgrimage you guys kind of foresee it to be, is the building, the sides of the building, or is there a potential area where they could add an external staircase so that a larger group of people might be able to get up there if it gets to that point? Or is this basically going to be a access upon request type situation? It's probably too early to tell, but these are just questions that pop into my head, because obviously I haven't seen the building.
I think that part of the draw is going to be the fact that it is the way it is right now, and that people have to go to the sixth floor on the elevator. They can only get to the roof by taking the side stairwell, which goes up to the anteroom brick building on top of the building, which you then go through this sealed door to this old wooden staircase that goes to a half door that you have to bend over to get out to onto the roof.
It's like
I think that whole thing is just, yeah, I think it's going to be part of the pull of it. And I think if anyone tried to make it better, there would be a lot of pushback on trying to make it more convenient. And but I do think though that Lawrence and I, the building owner, we've talked extensively, and I told him the reality is that when Marines find out about the significance of this place, and my nephew Seth is a Marine, and he and his buddies have permission from Mr. Siderly, the building owner, to make a first sergeant's cross, which they're going to be about 7-foot cross that they'll put up there. Nice. And in the middle, it will have the bronze imprint of the flag raising at Iwo. And across the crossbar of the cross, it will say Semper Fidelis. And Seth told me that in Marine Corps history and legacy, that when the Marines visit a place like that that has such a cross, they bring extra rank in a pin form and they push it into the wood of the cross. And this is something that Lawrence is very, very excited about the Marine Corps history and the lore. And we've talked about the fact that what we'll probably end up doing is having a website portal that people can sign up for tours between maybe 1 and 3 on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And they'll have folks that can then, Lawrence sees it as something that people actually put on their to-do list when they visit San Antonio, especially if they have Marine Corps history in their families. And then as more and more people visit it, I mean, I absolutely see more and more plaques going up there, different units, and the cross becoming absolutely full of pins and needing another cross. And Jeff, do you want to tell them about the flags?
Well, real quick, did the building owner have any idea of any of the historical significance? Did he,
None.
I think they did some Marine Corps stuff here in the past.
None.
Just completely, you just turned his whole life upside
Yeah,
down, and then he
absolutely
came
turned it
knocking on
upside
his
down.
office door like, "Hey,
And
fella, can I
the
see your
building
roof?"
belonged to his dad, and he grew up there. And as a kid, his dad, he says, "Hey, can I get make some extra money?" And so his dad says, threw him a big old wad of keys to the whole entire building and says, "Sure, go clean stuff." So Lawrence he knows every nook and cranny of that building, and he grew up in that building, and he had no idea the history. And what's even better is that the induction part of the Marine Corps was on the sixth floor where all of his offices are, the offices of the building. It's all on the sixth floor, and it's just great.
It'll be interesting at some point upon research if somebody finds some old microfilm of a newspaper doing an article about the recent batch of inductees coming out of there one day or something. I'm
For
sure that'll
sure.
pop up at one point. So, more information on this event you guys are talking about. It's going to be February-ish. What date? I mean, I know, is this hard set or are you guys still in planning phases right now?
No, yeah, it's a hard set for February 21st, and which is a Saturday afternoon. Of course, it's because of the nature of the building space, it is a limited capacity, type event. So when we do start really publicly promoting it, that's going to have to be very evident, that we're looking for essentially two types of people: one that will actually come to help support, but then two, folks that may not be able to come but would like to support in other ways, specifically donations to make sure that these plaques are done well. And we may be not replacing, but I think there's going to be some repair to the flagpole, or potentially a larger flagpole to house not just the American flag and Texas flag that fly there now, but to be able to put a decent size Eagle, Globe, and Anchor up there. So, I mean, on top of the sixth story building, you'll be able to see that from many blocks around San Antonio. So any Marine or former Marine's going to see that and go, "What is that? What is going on?" They're going to want to know. It's going to make them curious, and the building owner wants that. He wants people to go, "Wait, what is that? What does this plaque mean?" Down at the street level, the historical significance. Okay, I want to go inside and see what's going on here, and that's what he's hoping is part of the draw, as well. It's just the fact that there's a Marine Corps EGA flying above it.
You need a big brass one so the sun reflects off of it like a beacon. Now they have the brass one. So for this particular event day, when you guys do this ceremony, this opening, are you going to have any sort of like mannequins like Steve in the background or any sort of original era kind of gear? Not as permanent fixtures, but as part of this grand opening ceremony, is there going to be more modern suit tie type of thing? What's the theme you guys were discussing for the particular grand opening ceremony?
Well, obviously, we want as many active duty Marines as there as possible, so their uniforms don't look much different if they're in their blues. And then, yeah, Dennis and I are working on getting, several volunteers in P-41s, P-42s, World War II Marine Corps gear. I'm gonna put my Jeep on display. We're gonna have another guy with his World War II Jeep, table displays, combat gear. It doesn't necessarily. I think we're gonna just try to display a lot, as much as we can, about World War II. Obviously, this is very Marine heavy, but not necessarily Marine, and it doesn't have to be entirely Marine Corps related. This is World War II. So, Dennis wants like a USO theme, a 40s band playing, like Bob Hope's about to walk out in front of this giant 48-star flag banner. So yeah, there's a lot of things to talk through. There'll be drinks and appetizers and
I don't think we've covered this. What is the modern current use of this building? Is it a library? Is it a warehouse? Is it a sports bar? What's the current? Is it an office space with sublet units? What's the current use of this? And is there Are you guys going to have, is there like a meeting room you guys want to have the band playing and things like that?
The building is occupied by just a myriad of different kinds of businesses. It is an office space. So there's life insurance and there's architects and there's lawyers and law offices and graphic designers. And as far as where the event's going to take place, we're going to utilize a lot of the garage space, which is underneath the buildings, so to speak. The building envelops the garage space. And so it's kind of a nifty place to have people gather, and having a band there, the acoustics will be great. Plus, if it's there's any inclement weather, it's not gonna, people will have a place to, you know, go inside. But and then we go through what's called the history hall. It's this long white hallway of glass cases that they're refurbishing, which they're going to place a bunch of pictures from the building when it was just a skeleton with steel beams. And then one of the glass cases now is going to be all about the Marine Corps influence in the building. I had Captain Gaskin is the executive officer of the Marine Corps Southern Recruiting District for Texas, San Antonio. And he's offered to provide me a letter of introduction, because to your point specifically, Don, I want to get a hold of the museum, the Marine Corps Museum, because I want to see if there's any photographs of this place. Surely there was some guys snapping photographs.
Or even some cool documentation, you know, of enlistment cards or records that, you know,
for sure,
out of there. That'd be very cool.
Yeah. So, and I do like your idea of microfilm. So you've actually inspired me. I'm one of these weekends, I'm going to go down to the San Antonio Public Library and pull up the old microfiche from, you know, that time period and see what I can find.
See what the San Antonio Star Herald has.
Whatever. Yeah, exactly. San Antonio Light, San Antonio Herald.
Yep. That's awesome. I'm super excited for you guys. That is hugely impactful. This guy just going about his business, and here comes Dennis. Can I see your roof? What? I want to see your roof. What for? Roof inspector? Cable guy? No, I heard some fellas that did something 80 years ago I'm interested in.
I mean, it's wild. I go from knowing nothing to now on my keychain, I have keys to the building.
And the crazy thing is I can remember when we were doing that episode. I think Dennis even mentioned something like, I want to take a look at that. You mentioned, like, you could see the gears turning in your head when that photo came up. You're like, it's San Antonio, huh? And it wasn't too much longer. You were sending messages like, I think we found this bad boy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because I know San Antonio has a rich history of not, like, they'll gut a building, but they'll not allow you to tear it down if it's got some significant architectural designs. And so seeing the pediment and that flagpole, I knew there was just no way they were going to tear it down. So it had to be somewhere. And it just so happened the first right turn I took, walking, I look up and there's at Travis and Broadway is the flagpole and the
and if pediment. I remember the photo very if I remember the photo correctly, I think the pony wall around it kind of had some very unique ornate like design to it that you could easily spot. You know, it's not just a square flat roof that looks like
20. Yeah, thankfully. It had a very unique, its own unique pediment that the flagpole was behind. So it was just so easy to match up. And but you know, as a historians, you know, and writers, you have to be super skeptical, right? It's you have to do your due diligence. So when we got Harlan Block's service record and saw his induction papers with the heading says U.S. Marine Corps headquarters San Antonio 118 Broadway, I mean, it's the same exact address, and they're on the roof, and it's pretty awesome. The commander at the time was Captain Donald Taft, and so I've got some investigating to do on that end.
Is the Harlan Block family or any of the other men from the Wesley 08 photo, have any of them been reached out to the family about this event in anything in any sort of capacity?
Oh yes, I think there'll be five of the eight families that will come. The Harlan Block family, as you can imagine, there are inundated, right? By this point in time, they're over Like they are moving on with their life, and they've done as much as they can to honor his memory and his sacrifice. So, you have to, we have to respect
Sure.
that, goodness gracious, it's been 80 years, and they've had countless requests for, information and access, and they're just,
It's a daily occurrence for them.
yeah, they're just seeking peace.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would be great to have a members of the family there, and I think that what will probably happen is, years down the road, we'll hear, "Man, I wish that we had, or I wish that someone had got a hold of our side of the family," but we're.
Who knows if what you guys foresee this location becoming at some point, someone in the family might say, "Hey, I
Sure.
understand there's some historical stuff. Here's some letters, or here's something, by all means." And then they can check off
Absolutely.
the list. One last group of people who'll be reaching out to us.
I got to reach out to you guys. You have them.
Well,
Yeah.
fellas, I'm super excited for that. I don't know. We'll get together off air. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we can figure out a way to get from me to get out there, and we'll
That would be
see
amazing.
what we can do. But I don't see any other reason to try to cram anything else into this episode. I think it's been a very good episode, and to try to pigeonhole anything else into it would just be an injustice to that particular topic. I say we wrap it up here. Any rebukes or requests or anything of that nature?
I agree. I think it was great.
I'm, yeah, no, I, we'll definitely, we'll talk our other topic next time because I am pumped about that. But yeah, we just ask all of our listeners to kind of follow along and follow us as we go through this process and opening up this organization that all three of us will be playing a part in some way. And because we all have the passion, and it's going to take a lot of hands to make COG truly successful, and it's going to be, it already is way bigger than us. So we're just building our social media and our website now. Dennis, if you wanted to send him that information, you can, if you wanted to share it, or we can wait. But just a really truly special thing to be a part of. Anytime we're remembering World War II veterans in any way, through our podcasts, through our books, through our stories, through our artifacts, we're doing something right. And I saw a quote just earlier today that said that a generation that doesn't remember its past has no future. And that's a pretty powerful thing. So, they are slipping away, but we're going to make sure that they don't go away, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
One last announcement, because I don't think, no, it's relatively new. The What's the Scuttlebutt podcast now has its own dedicated freestanding YouTube page. I've been slowly transitioning all the old
Nice.
videos from D410 Media over to the new platform, and I've added the RSS feed, so all the existing, now not all 217 shows are available because of space limitations. So because of how web hosting works over the years, I've been deleting some of the older episodes, and then some of those get redistributed as best ofs. But because of space limitation, not all of them are up there, but all the shows that are actively available for download through RSS feeds are also being sent over there. So you need to watch them through YouTube, or if you have the YouTube podcast app, you can subscribe and actually listen to the audio for version of this podcast as well as watch all the videos. They're not all there yet. It's a long, long transition. I literally have to download each video, copy the description, copy all the hashtags, copy the thumbnail from D410 Media, wait until it downloads. Switch over to What's the Scuttlebutt and upload it. So it's going to take some time. But with all that being said, all the videos that were over on Analog 410, which was our backup page, have already been transitioned over there. I think there's already
That's
100
amazing.
episodes up there.
I'm really glad to
All the
hear that.
new ones are on their way. And then what we're going to do in the future is whenever we do a video, some of you guys may have noticed, sometimes we'll take an hour and a half show, cut down to a 30-minute clip, and then I post it. So what I'm going to do in the future, just until people all transition over, because we have such a larger audience on D410 Media, the full versions of the show will be sent over to the What's the Scuttlebutt YouTube page, and then the abbreviated preview version will be put up on 410 Media, pointing people to go subscribe to the What's the Scuttlebutt YouTube page and to watch the full version. So if you guys are subscribed to both channels, you might see a video twice, but one of them will be the shorter one because we're pushing 5,000 subscribers on D410 Media, and I don't want to lose that as an advertising base for What's the Scuttlebutt. So the full versions of the videos will be over on What's the Scuttlebutt. All the full version of the audio will be over there as well, and then I'll put up the short preview versions on D410 Media, pointing people over to What's the Scuttlebutt. So hopefully the subscription base will already transfer over there, and it's already building pretty quickly.
That's awesome.
I just want to put that out there, and we want to hear from you guys. We haven't done this in a while. We're really here at D410 Media. We're horrible at self promotion, and we're horrible about little things like asking you to email us at mailcall@wtspworldwar2.com. So send us an email. That's wtspwwii.com, just like it says on your books, wwii.com. Email us complaints, comments, suggestions. We've said this before. You guys know this. World War II is a huge, huge swath. The three of us can only cover so much. The three of us can only be embedded in so much. So if you have a part of the war that you think we need to cover or that you yourself know a lot about, because I know there's a lot of living historians on here, you feel you can come on and share your topic with us, pretend like we're the crowd in front of your living display tent, and you want to talk about something particular, reach out to us at mail call at wtspworldwar2.com. We'll happily have you on the show. And thank you guys for your continued support. I'm excited to see what Dennis and Jeff and Cog have coming up. And go ahead.
Yeah, we need to say congratulations to Jeff. Freaking worked his butt off for years and years and burning midnight oil. And he is officially a historian.
And, somebody has to lend some credibility to this podcast. we have an actually certified
all those historian. Late nights typing away when he wanted to be sleeping, but he pushed through it. All that hard work. And he is a bona fide. That's awesome.
He's bona fide. He's a suitor.
He's bona fide. And that's to be commended, because that is a lot of hard work, and it takes a lot to do. And I'm very, very proud of him. And yeah, it's awesome. Well done.
I appreciate that, guys. And you know, it's easy to say now that it's all over, but you know, really the best way I can sum it up is, you know, behind every good man is a great woman, and it wouldn't have happened without her. So, you know, even 4-star generals have bosses. So it really doesn't matter how high you get. It's always the one behind you that nobody sees that really made it possible. So, you know, she's the one that really kept everything going. And, you know, we've said this before in the war effort too, it took about 8 people on the home front to supply that one soldier. So, I think that's just another way to remember what it truly takes and sacrifice. And we're going to talk about that next episode when we invade the island of Tarawa for the anniversary. So looking forward to talking about that. Hope we get our listeners excited, because I can't wait to talk about Operation Galvanic.
And on that note, we'll talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.